Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, weary traveler. Need a short rest?
Oh, I see.
They said you'd be showing up about now. Come on, through the portal. Best not keep the Lore Mistress and Lore Master waiting. You know how they get.
Robots Radio presents the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. The best way for everyone from experienced dungeon masters to those curious about D&D to learn more about the worlds, creatures, and lore of Dungeons and Dragons.
Hello and welcome to an installment of the Dungeons and Dragons Lorecast Presents. My name is Sergio.
And I'm Mary.
We're talking with creators in this series. We're talking with the people behind the curtain, so to speak, the wizards, the behind homebrew campaigns, the things that we love to play that you can pick up either like on DM's Guild or in this case on Kickstarter. Yep. We're talking with Christian Allaire this time around. And he is the mind behind Rise of the Black Coven, which is available to be backed on Kickstarter right now. Mm-hmm. If you are listening to this in the end of January, I don't know where that came from. The end of June, beginning of July, when we're recording this, you can go ahead and back it now. It's already fully funded. It's already a project that's going to be realized. But we wanted to talk with Christian. We wanted to sit down with him and kind of pick his brain a little bit. Say hello to the fine folks out there in Lorecast land.
Hi, everybody. My name is Christian Allaire, and I am one of those eternal DM people.
Oh, you're one of those.
That answers one of my questions.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah, whether you prefer to DM or play, I guess.
Is it by preference or happenstance?
Or was that decision made for you?
It's a little bit of everything there, because after my very first campaign, I knew I wanted to DM, and then I did it a lot, introduced a lot of new people to D&D, and then I ended up in this position where I had a lot of players, and no one wanted to take on that mantle, so I just kind of kept doing it, and I was fine with that. That was great for me. I love pretty much every aspect of it. Whether running a standard module or world building, you get to play so many more NPCs than people get to play characters. So
that's a huge appeal for me too. Yeah. I get to be as many people as I want to be.
A lot of funny voices for sure.
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I still have not yet mastered the art of maintaining my accents that I apply in games. So
I can maintain them through the session. After that I never remember afterwards who sounded like what, and they're like, I don't think they sounded
like,
that way. I
was like Northern Scottish, or was he Irish? I can't remember.
we're doing a live stream right now to showcase the introductory adventure, and I am pretty sure every time I introduce one of the characters, their voice has changed in each episode. So
I'm so excited to go look at that. I found that today. I was looking through stuff earlier and found those earlier today and was going to bring it up. And I am absolutely going to be going back to watch that. I love a good actual play.
Oh, great. I'm excited to hear your feedback on it.
So you mentioned that you are the perpetual DM. You introduce folks to DM. How long have you been playing D&D specifically and tabletop games in general?
Oh, gosh. It has been nigh on 12 years or so since I first started playing. My friends got into D&D right when they started university, and I was near the end of high school. And they got me hooked in 3.5. And we've played a couple different...
Oh, welcome, brother.
Yes.
It's old man, too.
we played 3.5 for many years. But I've also played Pathfinder. I played a little tiny bit of 4th edition. I played a little bit of Call of Cthulhu. I've played... words escape me. The Wheel of Time RPG, very briefly. The Star Wars RPG that was effectively 3.5 as well. And now, of course, 5th edition. Lots of 5th edition.
Lots of 5th edition for sure.
Only 5th edition for me myself. I am still a newbie. But Sergio's an old dog. Been at it for a while.
I also cut my teeth on 3.5. It was weird for me because for a long time I was like D&D, like I'm a nerd, but I'm not that much of a nerd. Come to find out, I actually totally am. I am that much of a nerd.
You're
and
more
I love
than
it.
That much of a nerd.
I used to think that way about LARPing, but the more I see people's really nice cosplays online, I'm like, you know what? I could get into this.
I know a seamstress. I'm just gonna throw it out there.
The barrier now for LARPing would be time and money, where I would dive into it both feet first, and I would have no money or time for anything else. So that's like that's currently the only thing reining me back from just developing a very expensive new hobby.
It is an expensive hobby for sure.
Yeah, you're talking to two folks that just took up 3D printing. And and painting miniatures, so it's that's all we and on top of playing TTRPGs, that's all we know is it's expensive hobbies. It seems like
it's true. Oh, yeah. I have I work as a seamstress, so that is also a hobby in addition to the other things. So there's the sewing stuff. We've got sewing stuff here. I've got about any kind of craft thing you can think of. I do all of them if I can. That's my expensive dive is. All that stuff.
Thread is expensive. I'll just say that.
It is. It really is. Combine that with the D&D books, and I mean, might need to take out a couple more mortgages or something. I don't know.
So you mentioned you've been playing a lot of 5e. Let's talk a little bit about the Rise of the Black Coven specifically. This is a 5e campaign slash campaign setting as well. I read the description, I read the vibe. You mentioned specifically Ravenloft, being a huge fan of that. And I get Ravenloft vibes from it for sure. Mm-hmm. What were your goals in creating this project? And what give us some more of your inspirations besides Ravenloft?
For sure. So this campaign started initially as a Pathfinder campaign that I ran for some friends of mine after taking the 1998 Merlin miniseries a bit too seriously.
From sci-fi?
I forget what channel it was on initially, but Sam Neill's in it. It has a big cast for something that not a lot of people remember, but I loved it, and I ended up taking a lot of the aesthetics from that I liked to make this Pathfinder campaign, in addition to, very embarrassingly, that Hansel and Gretel movie where Jeremy Renner hunts witches with his twin sister Gretel. I forget what her actress's name is.
I hate to say it, but I super love that movie too.
Yeah, it is chef's kiss.
It is such garbage, and I adore it.
So that was the initial campaign when I was flying off the cuff. That was when I first built the world of Avalon, which is where the Rise of the Black Coven takes place. And we played through for about a year and a half, maybe close to 2 years in this one campaign, all about routing out members of the ubiquitous Black Coven. Mm-hmm. And then years went by, we transitioned from Pathfinder we got into fifth edition, and I ended up picking up the Curse of Strahd book, because one of the first campaigns that anyone had ever run from me was a mishmash of things, but we ended with going to Barovia and being in Castle Ravenloft 3.5. And reading the fifth edition version of the book, I was immediately enthralled. The structure is so very easy to take in, especially as a person who's been DMing for so long. I loved everything about the tone. I loved everything about the replayability aspect of it. And mm-hmm. I had always wanted to do to write my own full-fledged campaign, because mm-hmm. most of the stories I do are off the cuff. There's an overarching idea, but a lot of it is very dependent on whatever the players do, and then I kind of course correct based on that. But I wanted to write something down concrete, and reading into Ravenloft, I knew this is going to be the inspiration I have. I have to do something, and it has to do this. It has to mm-hmm. make me feel the way that this makes me feel, because I am spooked, but I'm not like frightened all the time. Like, it gives you such good direction mm-hmm. how to run the horror. It gives you excellent insight into how the world is crafted, and it gives you amazing options for replayability, because no two Curse of Strahd games are going to be the same. And so taking that as inspiration, I'm like, well, what could I do that I could take what I've learned from reading this module and other campaign modules, of course, too, but nothing really struck a chord with me as much as that one. What could I take and fit it so that it would be a campaign that someone could pick up and play as easily as they could pick up and use Curse of Strahd? And that's when I thought back to all the campaigns I ran, and the one that I had the most extensive world built for was this Rise of the Black Coven, where I still had all of my notes, everything that happened in the campaign. I had the world, we had returned to the world many times over just to play in different with different characters. So I'm like, mm-hmm. I know this like the back of my hand, I'm gonna dive into this. And so it still has a little bit of that goofy overtone that it had at first, but it also has a lot more of the dark, almost pseudo-gothic elements that Curse of Strahd has, without mm-hmm. really traipsing too far into horror or too far into comedy. In my mind, maybe I'm gonna fall flat for the comedy aspect or not be spooky enough. That will be for my viewers and readers to decide, but
that'll be at the tables, I assure you, because Curse of Strahd's the first campaign that I started running. And I am currently still running. And it's got a lot of silly in it, as serious as I try to be. And they will never, they will never be completely serious, I'm convinced.
I feel like you can leave it to players every time to do something a little ridiculous. And that does help to lighten the tone, no matter what the circumstances are.
Right. And that walking that line between those things is just such a beautiful thing. And it seems it looks and sounds absolutely like it is going to scratch all of those itches.
I'm very much hoping. I think we're doing okay with the live stream so far. We've been getting, you know, decent feedback, decent reviews. So mm-hmm. I'm very excited.
That's exciting. Live streaming D&D is terrifying for me, by the way. So massive kudos, because that scares me so much. And I've absolutely done it, but it terrifies me.
The benefit I have is that someone else is monitoring the chat feed and the actual stream itself. So I don't even open it. I am just focused 100% on the game.
Gotcha.
Because I cannot, I can multitask to a certain degree, but I can't do all those facets. And I would be too nervous and looking at the stream to see if I would have to address things.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not the players. I need to focus on the players at the table.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense for sure. Mm-hmm. So what you mentioned, you know, wanting to get the same, you wanted to feel the same way in writing the Rise of the Black Coven that you felt in reading Curse of Strahd and picking up, you know, that 5e module. What are some of your other inspirations for this? What are, you know, like the story for those who don't know, it's children are being taken. A dark cult is on the rise. Will your party be able to uncover their wicked schemes? And so it's, like you said, it does have that gothic horror element. It has amazing artwork from Danica Wells that you partnered with. I think the artwork, the art style that she's bringing to the title really complements it well.
It does.
So like what, how do you take your, I want this like sort of vibe and I have this idea. How did you like fully flesh that out into the product that, you know, we can see on the Kickstarter now?
There's been a lot of reworking. I've kind of had this in my head for so long, but I also have the advantage where I've been able to run so many different campaigns that I know the tone when it hits, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I can now translate that into words after having gone through so many other modules and how other people have constructed it. So I've kind of picked that apart and been like, okay, I'm going to take the structure bits that work really well like this, the tool tips like that I can find from each of these different campaigns.
Right. All the little DM tips, tricks and stuff like that.
Yeah. And from mm-hmm. there, just apply them to the writing. As far as Danica is concerned, it was actually kind of serendipitous. I went to high school with her. We hadn't spoken for many years. And then I ended up seeing her at HalCon, which is a Halifax Comic-Con, essentially. It's smaller scale because our town is tinier, but you know, mm-hmm. it's still our con, our big nerdy event of the year.
Yeah.
And I saw she had a booth. I'm like, Danica, I have not seen you in ages. She had this beautiful Inktober project called The Wickerwood. And as I was going through it, I'm like, I need you to do art for me. And I found this and picked this up months before I actually planned on finally taking the plunge and doing the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
But I reached out to her and I said, this is the art style that I want for this book. I think you can capture it because you have, it's very whimsical, but at the same time, there's like a little bit of spooky to it. And she's really good at capturing that nice in between.
Mm-hmm.
And she was all for it. I have some experience art directing as well. And in my professional life, I do graphic design and I have been a project manager and lead designer for teams at certain points. And so it's very easy for me to say what I want. And she has just taken everything I've said in stride and taken it and just, it's so easy. It feels so easy to communicate with her. She just fantastic. Gets it instantly to bring about this vibe.
Yeah, I'm looking at a drawing that she drew of the Pendle sisters. Mm-hmm. And it's like you said, it's very whimsical, but there's this kind of like dark undercurrent to it as well. This was brought to our attention by one of our patrons, mm-hmm. Jeff Steele of Gallo Glass Games. And immediately, like, I checked it out and I was like, I'm 100% in. Shot it over to Mary and she's like, yep, absolutely.
The decision took us less than 5 minutes. He was like, hey, what do you think? I'm like, yeah, let's go. And he's like, all right, cool. I'll let him know.
And you know, it's not, and it isn't just about, you know, the content itself, right. Which is 100% in our wheelhouse. It looks mm-hmm. incredible. I can't wait to play it. I can't wait to see it myself.
I'm excited too.
But also the fact that you are in the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. You have made it a point to highlight that community within, you know, in this adventure with NPCs. Can you just discuss a little bit about that and also like your motivations, like, you know, why that was important for you?
Yeah. So obviously being I am a gay man and there's a difficult narrative that keeps popping up in the media with the LGBTQ community because we keep having to fight more and more more vocally for things lately.
Mm-hmm.
Trans rights are always being jeopardized. There are constant struggles for the community. And yes. even though I am in Canada, which likes to pretend like things are better here. Oh, we're better. A lot of that, and no offense to anyone in the United States, a lot of our comparison a lot of our basis for saying that things are okay here for queer people is because we often say, well, at least it's not in the yeah. States.
At least it's not here. Yes.
It's so yeah. much, it's comparatively, it's a lot better than the United States for sure.
Yeah.
But there's still so much work that needs to be done because
agreed.
There is so much that is still at stake. Even just this past month, about an hour away from where I live, there was an anti drag story time protest.
Oh my gosh.
And thankfully, the counter protest that came up was like 6 or 7 times larger than the initial protest. So they just completely drowned them out. But those things still happen here. We don't necessarily talk about them as much. They don't necessarily make about as big of an impact, and they're not necessarily center stage politically, but there's always that chance that they become center stage. And with everything that is happening to the south of us, it's very important that queer representation comes into the forefront of media.
Absolutely.
And I am heavily invested in a lot of queer content creators online, particularly on YouTube. And it has a baffling history, queer representation in media. And doing a deep dive into it, it hasn't really gotten a lot better. We've had some very nice flickers of good queer representation, but a lot of the time there is token queerness or pink washed things, or we get a lot of shipped characters that are queer because the community ascribes those qualities to them. But we often get the same narrative for a lot of queer people. Jokingly, I say that lesbians are the safe queers, so you'll see them in a lot more media. A lot of people point out that lesbians are more prevalent because people fetishize, or straight men can fetishize lesbianism, and you won't see as many gay men or trans people. And you will also, a lot of the time when you do get gay men, you will get that narrative of the coming out story, and it has to be a big deal. Which that's good that we have that from time to time. It's good that we get lesbian representation. It is good that we are appearing in media now as more than just the villains. I mean, we all love a great Disney villain who are all queer coded, but
every single one, it seems like
every single one.
And fabulous.
It's true. And they are some of my favorite characters.
Rightfully so. They're so much fun,
but it's so much more fun.
Up until very recently, that was pretty much all we got as far as queer representation is coding and villainy. And now there's this hesitancy, and then we often get these narratives that are all about that coming out aspect. And that coming out aspect is predicated on the fact that coming out is a big deal. In an ideal world, no one would give a shit. And so that's kind of what I want in the narrative, where we have queer characters that are present, they are commonplace, because queer people are commonplace. We are absolutely everywhere. Sexuality is a wide spectrum of colors and attributes, and it sexual identity is a wide spectrum of colors and attributes.
Well, yeah, it goes with your fingerprint.
Yeah, there you go. They are as unique as your fingerprints. I love that.
Yes, absolutely.
And so where I wanted to include queer characters, not only were a lot of the characters that were in the initial runs of my campaigns and worlds played by queer people, but I wanted to include queer people in a setting where they are just common, they are present, they are everyday beings whose story is their own, and it's not that de facto coming out story, and who don't suffer from the same tropes that a lot of queer people suffer from in media. There's a whole bucket, there's a whole list of tropes that just kind of keep getting played over and over again, and I'm
sick
of
them. A lot of them problematic for sure.
Yep.
Yeah. that's the tirade version of why I want to have queer characters.
I'm absolutely here for it. So I do have a question though, because as I'm a supporter and member of the team there. So it is. Oh yeah. No, it's absolutely near and dear to my heart, and I have avoided crying so far, but we'll see. So from the side of running this adventure, what do you want, like what would your ideal be for DMs going into this? Because there is going to be a sensitivity, and I agree that there should not be, but to some extent it is an adjustment for some people, and as long as they're willing to meet me halfway, I'm usually cool with helping through an adjustment. So as a DM, how would you expect, or like, what would you want from that, from the tables? Like, how would you want to see that done? Like, what's your dream for it?
My dream would be that people take some of these elements in stride. The DM reading the narrative, a lot of the time, the sexuality of the characters and their relationships, it is going to be explained in how to role play the character and their motivations mm-hmm. and who they love or who they've been in love with. But ultimately, a lot of the time that doesn't come up. So it will be up to the DM whether or not they include it anyway, which is, right. You know, some DMs just won't. That's just the state of being. But ideally, I would want a DM to read it, take this in stride, because this is just normal. And mm-hmm. Some players might make a lot of hay out of it, but those aren't necessarily the people that I'm targeting anyway with this.
Right.
It sucks to say, but you're not going to convince people at the D&D table immediately if they find out some character is gay or right. lesbian or trans.
Oh, absolutely.
That's a much larger conversation you're going to have with them, because it's...
Right. Oh, for yeah. sure. For sure.
So I'm confident that it is manageable with a friend group or a D&D table, that mm-hmm. someone could have that conversation over a long period, but I'm under no illusions that like my campaign will change the world.
No, not by any means. Just more of a how to approach it without hitting those stereotypes, without ticking off all those annoying little boxes that we all see.
Oh yeah, so there's
the aspect I was going for too. That as well is hugely important as well.
I'm sorry, I think I misunderstood there.
No, it's okay. No problems.
I've definitely run into some hurdles, mm-hmm. because there needs to be. I like it when people care about the NPCs. I like it also when there are stakes involved in a campaign. Mm-hmm. And so harm coming to queer characters is not what I want to have happen, but harm might come to happen to some of them,
right.
Which is tricky because you've got tropes like lesbians don't get a happy ending, mm-hmm. which is a huge problem, where you bury your lesbians at the end of a story because they cannot have a happy ending together.
The historical, they were friends, good friends, companions, partners.
Good friends, or just one of them dies, so they don't get a happy ending together.
Right.
And that's tricky because it is D&D, so there is risk, there's combat.
Oh,
and
always.
There's an evil cult that is roaming about who might hurt people. So I'm definitely entering into some risky territory where some of the stage direction does put some characters in jeopardy, but I want to avoid those tropes at all costs. So I want there to be agency involved in players' choices. So players have the capacity to change the outcome of, naturally. They always do. Your players should always have agency. If you're a DM,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Pro tip.
Well, if you don't give them agency, they won't be your players for very long. So that'll probably sort itself out.
Exactly. So that's the crux of it, where I give stage direction for how harm can potentially come to certain characters, but it's something I'm conflicted with too, because I want to avoid that. Like the right. goal of the campaign is not to have queer people come to harm; it is to have them be represented.
Right. Yeah, and that's a delicate like tightrope. That's to walk.
It is
that you want to have, you know, this representation for this group of people that makes it seem like, hey, like, you know, this is run of the mill. This isn't anything, you know, out of the ordinary. But at the same time, you don't want to, and keeping in that idea, like, okay, well, they could be victims of this cult, but then you don't want to fall into the trope of like, oh, okay, well, like they're always victimized, they're always the victims of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I'm very interested to see like how that plays out, and I really like your answer about giving the players agency and being able to decide, like, you know, or not decide, but have that power in what, you know, what fate befalls these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not entirely dependent on the character themselves, you know, to who they are, you know, what, you know, their characteristics, but more so what role in the story are they playing.
Yeah. I don't want anyone to have that the plot armor, as one might say.
Right.
But I want there to be, you know, emotional investment. And no one feels emotionally invested if they are wrapped in bubble wrap, but it's something I want players to care about the NPCs, but also therefore want to protect them. And players, I think a lot, most, not all, but most players want to be the heroes of the story. So I think that lends itself naturally to help keeping these people safe.
No, right. Absolutely. For sure. And so, like I said, the Kickstarter is going on right now. It's fully funded already. Less than 2 weeks into the campaign. What was your reaction when you found that out? When you got the notification that like, oh wow, like this has been not only as successful as I hoped it would be, but now more, that. Yeah, now surpassing that goal.
Oh, it is it is an incredibly stressful experience still. I'll be honest. So I have 100% developed a bunch of unhealthy habits because of this. So I am in a constant state of pseudo disbelief and anxiety, just watching those numbers go up and down. And I've had people pledge, and I've had people withdraw their pledges. It doesn't feel real yet, and I don't think it will until it ends. Jeff from Galaglass Games was a huge blessing becoming the sponsor, because that just took away a lot of my anxiety off the bat. But there's still a lot for me left to do, and I still have to keep promoting it, of course. So I'm still like a hummingbird on social media, just constantly trying to post things, write things, get the word out. I've been trying to talk to small businesses to see if they want to place wholesale orders. I still feel that like constant vibrational hum, just like I've had 8 cups of coffee.
Just 8? Is that a lot of coffee for most people?
I actually don't drink coffee most of the time, because it gives me the anxious jitters.
No, I need that's more coffee for me, so that's fine.
Yeah, you can have all same. Of it. I'll drink a tea every once in a while.
So Rise of the Black Coven, it is over 200 pages. It's got 8 unique dungeons for characters from levels 1 to 12. It's a full-fledged campaign, designed to take your characters from beginning to, what for all intents and purposes is kind of like the bottleneck of D&D 5th edition. at a certain point, and we've discussed this in episodes proper, how the system kind of for better or worse, that kind of gets OP at a certain point. It's right around 12, 13 level, 13 unique monsters and NPC stat blocks, as well as 12 new magic items. In addition to being the campaign itself with all the NPCs, all the monsters, all the magic items, everything you could hope for, expect in a campaign, it's also the campaign setting itself. So can you talk to us a little bit about Avalon?
Of course. So
can you, as a DM, discuss your homebrew world?
Can you discuss your
absolutely
homebrew
not,
stuff?
No. Oh gosh, buy me dinner first. Now the campaign setting is Avalon. It is probably the world I've returned to the most as a DM. It is more specifically set in a country called Alexandria. And the first incarnation of this, I was a very ambitious young DM, and I made the whole world map and gave unique attributes to all these different countries. But for the purposes of Rise of the Black Coven, I reined a lot of that back in so that it could be more easily inserted into someone else's world as well.
Right.
So Alexandria sits at the end of a continent to the north. There are some countries to the south that you can play with if you'd like. They don't have a lot of detail by design input onto them, and part of my stage direction is use your world if you'd like to insert this and replace names as necessary. But Alexandria, the country, is a nation that was once a bunch of divided city-states, and it was originally a part of the world that had as its predominant religion, a what we would call a pagan religion, worshiping archfey instead of deities. And so I've taken the religious aspect and used a lot of characters from pseudo-pagan myth and Arthurian myth and some Shakespeare. So this also harkens back to that 1998 Merlin, where we have prominently featured Mab, Queen Mab, and the Lady of the Lake as two of the over deities. We've got the Morrigan, so she's I believe a Celtic deity as well as an archfey, and all of these entities essentially governed their own section of the world relatively peacefully until a war broke out, and this war ravaged someone's village, and her name was Sarah. And Sarah made a pact with an archfey and used the power that she got therein to vanquish the invaders and unify her country. So all of these disparate city-states came together and formed the country of Alexandria. However, it came with a twist. So there is a religious sub-theme that goes throughout the campaign. And a lot of this isn't necessary for the actual running of the campaign, but it's all for context.
We're all about the lore here.
Oh, yeah. I figured.
Yeah, I don't know if it's indicative of the name of the show, but yeah, we do love the lore. So by all means, do proceed.
Well, thank you. So in uniting these disparate city-states, the pact with the archfey that Sarah had made, she deemed that archfey to be superior to all others and deified her. Her name is Eos, the fey of dawn, harvest. In other versions of the games, if we could use the name Paelor, she might be a female version of Paelor or an equivalent thereof, and banned all other pagan worship until her deathbed, where she recanted and reinstituted paganism and refounded the church, which leaves us at an interesting spot historically, several hundred years after, where we've got this person who had been heralded as a hero, who became a conqueror and a tyrant, who founded a religion that then split apart and reconfigured itself, where the world is kind of at a weird power crossroads, where there is this tension between returning to pagan roots and maintaining an orthodox tradition. And those two elements coming into conflict kind of set the stage for how the Black Coven gets about doing what it's doing in the modern era of Avalon.
Yeah, that's I love some good world building for sure. 100%. And it sounds, you've mentioned that this is a world that you've used in several different campaigns throughout the years, one that you've been sort of crafting and molding little by little up until, I guess, this is the culmination of years of work and more to come. One thing I wanted to ask for sure is, if you look at the Kickstarter, the different tiers that are available, the lowest tier, it's $5, $5 Canadian or $4 US, which is relatively low. That's for a PDF of the campaign, of the entire campaign and adventure. So you could own this, you can own a digital version of it for as little as $4. You know, what was the motivation behind pricing that so low?
So my initial thought was that I wanted the campaign to be as accessible as possible. Now, before Galloglass Games came on board and I was still stressing out, I was thinking that I had made a mistake because I was panicking and anxious because I saw a lot of other people on Kickstarter charging more for their PDFs. But especially now that Galloglass is on board and everything is funded and everything, a lot of the stress has gone. I am still a bit manic, but a lot of it was motivated by the fact that I want people to be able to play it. This wasn't a project I undertook for profit. If I make a profit, great. That's fantastic. I say that in my little intro video. But the idea is that I want to make something and I want to make it available to people. And as you mentioned, it's $5 Canadian, about $4 US. So I'm hoping, I've been looking at my numbers and it seems most people are very much interested in that tier, which is great. Cause I want people to play it. I want the thing that I have made to be out and about in the world and for people to be able to enjoy it and maybe see themselves in some of it, you know?
No. Yeah. And that's, sure. You know, I've discussed, the aesthetic, the vibe being in our wheelhouse. I've discussed the fact that representation is so crucial in this being another reason. And that's another reason why we're so excited about this project is, like you said, if you end up, you know, turning a profit, which would be fantastic, all the better. But really your main motivation is to have people play it, to create something that can, you know, bring people joy, which is beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you.
For the record, though, I definitely am a, as you can tell from behind me, I am a hoarder of TTRPG books. And so I definitely backed the physical version tier of it because I just can't help myself. Like,
he has no self-control.
I gotta stay off of Kickstarter. It seems like every time I go on that website, I'm backing something else.
I feel you. The smaller creatives on Kickstarter are very helpful towards each other, because I've reached out to people for doing cross promotion, and they've reached out to me, and you get this really nice, helpful network of people willing to promote each other's work. But at the same time, whenever I see a project that I am cross promoting and I really like, I pledge to it. And so, a lot of my money is tied up in Kickstarter right now that I didn't expect to be.
No, yeah, it's
everybody's supporting each other, and it comes out in the wash, kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. We're all elevating each other.
Exactly.
But yeah, there's it's just one of many projects, like you said, that is fantastic on the platform. Why Kickstarter? I've never created one myself, but you've mentioned the anxiety and the stress. Why that route over more traditional publishing?
Honestly, part of me was very fearful that the professional market for campaigns was saturated. So I also knew that with D&D 1 or D&D Next or whatever we're calling it now is on its way, that there would be a shelf life for anything that I make in fifth edition out of whole cloth. And so I knew that there was still an appetite for campaigns and settings because I still see them popping up, but other publishing houses, I don't know. I didn't think that they would want to grasp at a single creative's world-built idea. And it's a bit presumptuous. I thought it was a bit presumptuous of me to go up to someone and be like, "Hello, would you like to buy this story I've been working on?" Where it might have provided some security, I also felt it would be a more difficult avenue to approach. Mm-hmm. I've also mentioned that I have a background in graphic design, so the book will be laid out by me, which is a big easy thing for me. And so there's a lot of stuff that I knew I could accomplish on my own if I just had the funds to do it. So it probably hasn't helped my anxiety knowing that I'm doing a lot of that work, but the other avenue I thought was going to be more of a dead end. And I'll be honest, I did not pursue it. I could have been completely wrong on that. I launched Kickstarter because I had confidence in it, and I had seen projects funded before, and my friends talked about the projects that they had funded. I'm like, I can do that. I can be audacious and try to get something funded on Kickstarter. And here we are.
I think it's working out fantastically, and I'm really glad you decided to go for it.
Thank you.
And yeah, that's part of the reason we started, this particular series and talking to content creators, not just, getting picking their brains about the creative process and, what makes mm-hmm. them tick, but also kind of like the how the sausage is made, so to speak. And mm-hmm. so do you have any advice for, that creative out there listening to this, who is considering taking the plunge into crowdfunding to release a module or to release a zine, to do something, but something they need that little push to send them over the edge. What can you tell them?
Oh, I think the biggest takeaway would be art is expensive and you should pay your artist well.
Hell yes, brother.
We agree.
Yeah. Your artist will be putting in a ton of work. And I've done some illustration work in the past, and I would never be able to get out of my own head about it. Just the way I am, I would overly critique my own stuff. So Danica was a serendipitous blessing. And she has also been incredibly generous in our arrangement and our contract. So I can't rave about that enough, but art is very expensive, and your artists, if they are doing this as their full-time job, then they need to be compensated appropriately. And the legal use of their artwork in publications can be it can be difficult to navigate because you might only acquire the artwork for limited runs, or you might be, if you're very lucky, you might get unlimited usage. But secure an artist who will work with you at a budget that you think you can afford, and figure out how your relationship is going to work. That is the biggest takeaway I can say. Layout and design, once you have the writing and all of that, hiring a graphic designer is a little easier than hiring an artist, because a graphic designer isn't going to keep intellectual property ownership of the work under most circumstances, but the artist's IP, their portfolio, that is their livelihood, is going into this, and that should be honored and respected.
Awesome. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what I would kind of answer I was looking for, something that a lot of people might not necessarily consider when approaching a project like this of their own. But yeah, and that's another thing that I loved about your project, is that you explicitly state, like, you know, like of the original, like, funding amount, you put exactly like what's going where, like how much the artist is getting paid, yeah, how much it's going to cost to print the hardcover books, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Like, as the transparency is really it's
very
nice.
Refreshing. It really is. It's nice.
I wanted it to be very clear, like what everything was going to cost me. And it was very funny, because a friend of mine approached me and goes, "I saw your budget. Yeah, it looks very reasonable." I'm like, "Yeah, but it looks like you're making none money." I'm like, "You're correct. I will be if everything is exactly this, I will be making none money."
Ah, none money.
None money.
So is this going to be a one-time thing, or are you planning on continuing to expand in this world and create an entire, like, a series of modules or different level adventures and things like that? Or is that something you want to see from the community, seeing what they come up with your ideas too, or a little of both?
Ooh, a little of both. So for any third-party content that uses the Dungeons and Dragons system that adheres to the OGL, you have to declare what can and cannot be used for iterative work, and I pretty much say use everything. The only there's very limited things that you cannot use except Danica's artwork. That is hers,
right?
But otherwise, I would love to see people write modules in Avalon. I think that would be a huge homage. At the same time, this has gone really well. I would love to be able to do this. Pie in the sky dreams, I would be writing adventures and modules as my full-time job.
That's kind of what I'm doing here too. Would love to be doing this just permanently, and this is all I do. Talk to people about Dungeons and Dragons and art that goes with Dungeons and Dragons. Like, I'm down.
Yeah. that living the dream.
Living the dream.
I feel like having the first one done, and once it is fully produced, published, and distributed, that is a thing that not everybody does, especially as effectively a one person operation.
Yeah,
that will probably be a good portfolio piece. A good way to get my foot in the door with either a publishing house or for making people interested in another campaign.
Very nice.
Yeah, we absolutely hope to see it. Like I said, it's everything about it is, like, it's right in our wheelhouse. You know, we're both, you know, fans of the whimsical and the spooky. You know, we're both huge proponents and supporters of representation, especially in TTRPGs. And I can't rave about this enough. You know, if you are listening to this and you're interested at all, there will be links in the show notes to the Kickstarter, of course, to all the social medias,
right,
for Christian, for Danica. And like we said, it's, if the PDF, the digital copy of the book, it's $4. If you are interested in, I love this. You have postcards. One of the tiers, you include postcards that you can send to people, or you can keep. You can, you know, keep and frame, which I probably will. But you can send them to friends and use them potentially as like a campaign invitation.
Oh, as a, like a prop for the campaign.
Exactly. Oh, yeah,
I love it.
For Avalon, for Alexandria, which is very cool. Like greetings from, you know, sort of thing, which I thought was really cool. But yeah, like go out and support this project. It's
for sure.
when we were approached by Jeff about this, you know, we're like, we talk about the things that we look interesting, that mm-hmm. you know, we would that we would love to play ourselves. That's the things that we champion, and this is definitely one of those projects.
I'm so glad. Thank you so much.
Well, thank Christian, you. Before we let you go, is there anything else that you wanted to add? Anything else you wanted to say?
I will say our Kickstarter runs until July 11th, so please check us out. If you wanted to find me on social media, I am at Sending Spell on pretty much every platform. Just another big thank you to a couple people, Gallo Glass Games, Jeff, for being the sponsor of this. You have been an amazing boon who just happened to cross me, which is fantastic. And there's a couple small retailers just in my neck of the woods. They're called The Deck Box and Monster Comic Lounge, and they were the first two people to place wholesale orders for the book. So it's going to be carried in some retail establishments too.
Awesome.
Support small businesses. Support your local game store, everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll end on that note. Yeah.
I love it.
Well, thank you so much, Christian, for joining us again. Rise of the Black Coven. It's on Kickstarter now through July 11th. Go check it out. Support indie creators, support queer creators, support local businesses, support mm-hmm. Artists and their and pay them accordingly. All those things that we've touched on in the show, we just yes. want to double down on.
Always got to take care of them, man.
Thank you,
the heart and soul of the community, man.
Thank you so much for listening. My name is Sergio,
and I am Mary.
Fare thee well, dear listener, and until we meet again, may all your 20s be natural.
Thank you for listening to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. If you've enjoyed the show, consider following us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at D&D Lorecast, or jumping into the Robots Radio Discord to chat more with us about Dungeons & Dragons. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to a Robots Radio podcast. Smart shows for interesting.